What's up, sports fans? This is Sports Odds and Ends, episode 101, bringing you all the sports news. It has finally happened. We are here. Kawhi has been signed. But before we get to that, I'm King Kaz. I am joined by my co-host, basketball fan extraordinaire. He's been staying up nights and weekends trying to figure out where Kawhi is going to go, the one, the great JVZ.
Okay, I haven't been that deep into it, and then when it actually happened, I completely missed it.
Yeah. It was like, it's like when you're watching something waiting for it to happen, and as soon as you start to like fall asleep a little bit, that, and you're like, what I missed it.
Oh yeah, I was checking my phone at the summer league games because it, you know, obviously what's happening with him is more interesting than what's happening with the basketball happening right in front of me. So yeah, so there's that, and then it just kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed. I don't know. It's weird saying that it was delayed. I mean, he can take as much time as he wants to make a decision, but
it
because he actually took that time, because he was the one person in the entire NBA that actually followed the rules and didn't negotiate a contract before before he was allowed to negotiate one. It just kind of threw the world into a frenzy trying to figure out what he's going to do, track his plane, just all the creepy shit that fans do.
So let's kind of break this down in the mythology of...
Well, actually, before that, let's do our roundup of stories.
Let's do our roundup.
Yeah, so last night, John Jones and Amanda Nunes retained their titles at UFC 239. Probably a highlight of the event was
most boring fights.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there were a couple exciting knockouts.
If
that's your thing, then definitely check out some of the clips from that event, because Jorge Masvidal probably scored the fastest knockout ever.
Over Ben probably, Masvidal. Yeah.
Basically, with a diving. Can you call it a diving knee strike, a jumping knee strike? A
jumping knee strike, yeah.
Just basically straight out of the gate.
Balls to the wall. Yeah, he kind of just takes a leap of faith and connects, and then does... So it's going to look excessive. The only excessive part is the celebration. That's is what I will say. Everything else is what you're supposed to do in that kind of... fighting system. You keep hitting until somebody tells you to stop.
Well, the jumping into an opponent probably is not a good idea, but in this case it kind of worked. You'll just have to check out the clips for that. And then Amanda Nunes with a Holly Holm style knockout on Holly Holm. So basically just add another big name to the list of fighters that Amanda Nunes has beaten. She's basically beaten everybody at this point in the UFC women's division, mm-hmm. or at least in her weight class. Okay, so moving on to soccer news. The USA beat the Netherlands this morning 2-0 in the finals to win their second World Cup in a row.
A pretty good breakdown somebody sent me of, it was a more of a comparison of like the women to the men, and like oh, the women are better. Yeah, they are, but I understand people's weirdness of the situation as like, yes, the women play better, but the men get more endorsement and things like that. The sports, it's changing, but you know, it is always going to be what it is. So they won this year. They won in 2015. They came in second in 2011. 07 was third. 03 was third. 99 was one of the big wins that I think a lot of people remember.
Yeah. That was the iconic Brandi Chastain penalty.
Yeah.
And then they won the inaugural one in 1991, so
mm-hmm. that's four and 95 wins. They came in third as well.
So I think I think from that you can kind of tell that, you know, they started out pretty dominant and then kind of drifted away for a little bit. I mean, it's kind of weird to say that when, you know, when you come in third. Yeah, a big win in 99 that kind of put the team on the map again. And then a couple, I guess, slightly disappointing performances and a little bit of controversy in between. The last tournament, they kind of reestablished themselves back at the top. And I think this year they pushed the gap even further, despite how much women's soccer has grown around the world. It's a relatively, like, I mean, we talk about it as if, like, yeah, I mean, obviously the women are better than the men. They've outperformed them in every single tournament. Like, we're just used to that. But the rest of the world, I think, is still catching up. Like, we've seen
the rest of the world and the rest of the U.S. in certain regard is starting to catch up with that fact. And I think it kind of falls back into one of the situations we talked about a long time ago when we talked about some of the problems of the U.S. men's national team, being that soccer isn't always taken as a primary sport after high school or college for a lot of people. And if they do pursue it, our system here in America doesn't boast well for really pushing that premier talent. A lot of that premier talent ends up playing in places like Europe or France or Germany or other places. And I think we just don't have a good system of really finding and pushing our premier talent. There's a lot of young, talented American stars out there, but I don't think our coaches at that high level are really, 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 really know how to kind of corral that talent on the men's side.
I think the U.S. women's national team does a better job of bringing that talent to light than the men's team does, simply because kind of the national team on the women's side is almost kind of the only place you get to see these women play. Like, they've tried to start up leagues, and I think hopefully the current iteration now, the NWSL is, or the NSWL is going to be the one that lasts. But on the men's side, kind of that they kind of make their names known in the MLS or in whatever European team scoops them up, and then you hear about them, you know, working their way up into the national team. Whereas this team, it's kind of this is the clear top team. This is a clear flagship operation. Just in general, like the women's national team has done a great job of putting stars on the map, and as their old stars retire, they do a really good job of you know, filling them in with newer stars. This was an all around good, it was a dominant performance. It was almost boring in the way in like the fact that there was kind of a clear gap between the U.S. and the other teams, and it's kind of like we talk about it each time that we're expecting the gap to close as the rest of the world catches up, but then as the rest of the world catches up, the U.S. continues to push themselves further. So great job to them. 26 goals in 7 games, which is a world record, a World Cup record, and they only conceded 3 goals. That on its own is pretty dominant. Both the golden and silver boots, the two top goal scorers came from the U.S. Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan. Megan Rapinoe won the golden ball for the tournament's best performer. Okay. The bronze ball was given to Rose Lavelle, one of the young players that we're talking about. She definitely put herself on the map in this tournament. Sweden won bronze. They beat England 2-1. That's just to kind of round out the news. And I guess to bring up the U.S. men again, they're playing Mexico today in the Gold Cup final, as we expected.
Yeah, that is the kind of lesser of the two tournaments we talked about. Speaking of rounding out the roundup, Joey Chestnut, hot dog eating competition contestant, ate 71 hot dogs to win his 12th straight Nathan's hot dog eating contest, which I think is a record. I don't know if that's, I mean, it's a record for him, but I don't know where that ranks.
He has the record, and that's at 74. So he fell three hot dogs short. He set that in 2018. But yeah, I think just as a kid watching this competition every July 4th, it was him and Kobayashi going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but yeah, since he actually finally beat Kobayashi, he's basically pushed the envelope every time. And he's won, like you said, he's won 12 straight. So,
yeah. Speaking of, ESPN has a really good 30 for 30 on their competition that has been going on for all these years and stuff like that, which Kobayashi no longer participates in most of the, and he didn't participate in this event, but he hasn't participated in a while, according to this article and some other stuff that I read. But yeah, that 30 for 30 is supposed to be surprisingly good, which isn't all that surprising because the 30 for 30s are an amazing documentary series put on by ESPN. And if you haven't seen them, you should definitely go check them out.
A former governor of Rio de Janeiro, Sergio Cabral, admitted to paying $2 million in bribes to the International Olympic Committee to get votes to award Rio de Janeiro the 2016 Olympics. This is just kind of, I don't know, news like this comes out and it's like, yeah, of course it was corrupt. that's kind of my reaction to this. Just like,
but this definitely is going to open up DGM from the producer booth. If it's not the IOC, it's FIFA.
it's basically all of these international sports organizations are there's just so much corrupt money being handed around in order to award competitions to specific places and events. It's just a mess. Eventually these guys get caught, but then, you know, the damage is done. The city already got the event. The event took place 3 years ago. I don't know what they're going to do about it now, other than this guy's in jail.
I think it opens a can of worms of who was in positions of power to accept those bribes and to start looking into that rather than what that particular situation in the past means. It more means, who were those people? Are those people still in position of power? Are those people still accepting bribes? You know what I mean? Like it opens up that more than anything else. That's been the roundup. Let's move on, surprisingly, to probably most people, because we don't talk about it enough here, to tennis news.
Yeah. Corey, aka Coco Gauff, has taken the tennis world by storm. First she made the news by beating Venus Williams in the first round. She's 15 years old, which is pretty amazing. A 15-year-old upsetting one of the world's best tennis players, that on its own is news. She's basically kept on winning. She's ranked 313 in the world, and she keeps racking up wins in the most historic tournament in tennis. And so now she's advanced to the round of 16, which is the fourth round, which is her most recent match. I think she was down pretty late, I think with the second set in the second set tiebreak. And then she managed to win that tiebreaker, win the set, win the third set. She's another young athlete putting her name on the map. She's the youngest player to advance this far since Jennifer Capriati, another American, since who did it in 1991. So,
yeah, this has kind of been the big story of when, well, this and Andy Murray and Serena Williams have kind of just been the big stories of Wimbledon that everyone is talking about. This very much is kind of the dominant factor, though, and is really interesting because being that young, and I think this was kind of very similar to the upcoming of Venus and Serena, being very young and then having that dominance factor that you can see early and then building on that. And then Serena has just been one of the most dominant women in tennis for so long. And so this kind of has that air to it of like kind of young Serena and Venus Williams, like kind of coming into tennis and being dominant at these places that in all regards, they shouldn't.
You bring up the Williams sisters, but then also, like I mentioned, Jennifer Capriati, who is the last really, really young person to to reach this point. And I think her career didn't quite match theirs. And I think a lot of that was kind of due to burnout. And so, like, because of that, there's rules in place to prevent players that are that young. Basically, Goff is allowed to play 10 tournaments a year just to kind of like ease her into it and prevent her from burning out. But you know, she's also been allowed to participate in a couple more just because she's performed so well. So,
and I mean, tennis is a long game, and it is a very physical game, really hard on the knees and shoulders, like style of game. So I understand the wanting to limit thing.
But then when you've got a star like this, it's important to capitalize on it.
But I think. In light of it, right? Tennis is a very.
You do have to be protective of them, just in the same way that you have to be protective of like a young pitcher, just so that they don't tear up their shoulders while they're too young, and you know, just as the bodies are still developing, like you don't want to mess them up.
Like as big as tennis,
leave the heavy play to when they're adults.
Yeah, and it kind of has this air like golf does, right? Where as long as they're those people that you want to help represent the sport show up at the biggest tournaments, the kind of smaller ones, you can be okay with them not participating in. You know, like obviously Wimbledon is going to be a really big showing. Probably the U.S. Open.
Yeah, the four Grand Slams, Wimbledon, yeah, US four... Open, Australian Open, French Open.
I think those will definitely be the ones that they wanted to participate in, but kind of the ones in between, they're not going to be like, it's not going to be a thing where if she sits out, people are going to be like, what? Why would she ever? Like, I feel like tennis is a little more understanding in those things. As long as you show up to the big deals, and you keep your points high, you know, it's all good.
So she's earned a total of $200,000 in this tournament, and she's basically too young to even like know what to spend that money on at this point, because she can't drive yet, so she can't buy a car. So like at this point, it's like
spend it on getting better, hire the best trainers, figure out who Serena's trying to hire and hire them away from her.
Yeah,
just do that. All right, let's talk about some basketball news. Let's get on to the court.
Yeah. An earthquake happened during Summer League, and not just during Summer League, but this was. Like as cool as a natural disaster could be, it was kind of cool watching this unfold on Twitter. And I say that as a California resident who has kind of just grown up with the idea that like an earthquake can just take me out at any time. So it's just like a thing that I'm just comfortable with. A magnitude 7.1 earthquake struck Ridgecrest, California, which is kind of in the mountains in between Las Vegas and Los Angeles. So it is a fairly remote area, but it was such a large earthquake that it was felt, it was felt both in Vegas and in Los Angeles and parts of the Central Valley of California as well. The interesting thing about this is that there were sporting events going on in both Vegas and Los Angeles at the time. The NBA Summer League had two games going on at the same time. One of them was the much anticipated matchup between Zion Williamson and RJ Barrett. Zion Williamson played for a little bit, made a big splash, and then bumped knees with somebody. So because he got a bruise from that, they pulled him out of the game and they pulled him out of Summer League entirely. Taking extra precautions with their prized number one draft pick. So after that, that's when the earthquake occurred. The Thomas and Mack Center, where some of the games were going on, the scoreboard above the court was swaying. So I mean, those things are suspended by a lot of very, very strong cables, but it's still it doesn't instill confidence when you look up and a big heavy thing is swaying up there and it looks like it might fall on you at any moment. So naturally they canceled games there. The other game that was going on didn't have an overhead scoreboard. So they just kept playing after they inspected the court because some of the floorboards had separated from the earthquake. So it's one of those weird things. Like a natural disaster can, if you expect one thing to be okay or to be like working properly, it's the actual floor that you're running on. And in that case, when you have an earthquake, that throws even that sort of thing into whack. But it looks like the gaps weren't big enough for them to stop playing. And both teams agreed. Both teams inspected the court. They both agreed that everything was okay to keep going. So they kept playing in that venue. A WNBA game was taking place between the Las Vegas Aces and the Washington Mystics at the Mandalay Bay Arena, and so that game got suspended at halftime. It's still suspended. They haven't finished it, so we'll see what they decide to do with that. And then over in Los Angeles, a Dodgers-Padres game was going on, but in that case, I think the players barely noticed what was going on. They just kept going.
You can see all the cameras, every camera angle is shaky AF.
Yeah, the announcers totally noticed what was going on, and you could kind of hear the panic in their voice. Apparently, the upper deck basically was running towards the exits. I think the cool thing about this is that, there's videos of several different sporting events in several different cities, all where you can see like the same reaction to the same event, all the same natural disaster all happening at the same time. So just kind of a cool moment in Twitter and in sports and in just like that. This is the age we live in that we can all experience this one momentous occasion together. So that just one interesting thing. But I think the real earthquake happened later in the day when Kawhi Leonard finally announced his decision This happened at around midnight in the West Coast. So I think a lot of people were still asleep. A lot of people had already gone to bed, resigned to the fact that they were going to have to wait one more day to find out where Kawhi Leonard was going. It was kind of down to the two LA teams, the Clippers and the Lakers, and the Raptors. He ended up choosing the Clippers, which that on its own, I don't think it was kind of a surprise because most of the talk was surrounding the Lakers and the Raptors. So either he was going to stay with the Raptors or he was going to go to the Lakers. There were just leaks everywhere. And actually, I don't know if I would even call them leaks. It was probably just unfounded speculation for people who thought they had sources. DDM basically calls it bullshit, which, yeah, I mean, I don't. It was a bunch of bullshit from just everybody who thought they had a source on the inside. Just talking heads, just needing something to talk about. Like everybody at one point, the Lakers were in the lead for it. Some people were throwing around percentages like 99% that he's going to sign with the Lakers, 95% that he's going to re-sign with the Raptors. I mean, and these things were being said like within hours of each other by different people. So in the end, none of them really knew anything because he signed with the Clippers.
So kind of let's kind of break down this Bond level genius villainy that Kawhi took part in. So Kawhi signs with the Clippers.
And JVZ.
Yeah.
Earlier in the show, you said that Kawhi Leonard didn't break the rules during free agency and the off season. And I might challenge you on that in a minute.
I think that's a fair challenge because I know what you're getting at with that. Because he didn't break the rules regarding the time periods in which he was allowed to negotiate and sign. Basically, everybody had they announced on Sunday free agency is open, and then at that point. Basically we knew most of the deals already at that point. So that was the rule that he didn't break. He actually took the entire week to, quote unquote, make a decision. Turns out now that during that time, he might've been negotiating behind the scenes, straight up tampering himself, because the Kawhi news went down and then within minutes, it was announced that Paul George was traded from the Oklahoma City Thunder to the Los Angeles Clippers as well.
Yeah, that was kind of the genius Bond level villainy I was gonna get down and kind of break. But so this is interesting, right? So Kawhi goes to the Clippers. The Lakers and the Clippers play in the same building. So it kind of creates not only this instant inside LA rivalry, but it creates a very must watch for LeBron's Lakers and now Paul George and Kawhi's Clippers as to who is going to be the best, right? Because obviously everyone at this moment is going to forget about the Golden State Warriors, even though I think they are still, so to speak, the most dominant team there until everybody plays. So now this roster that currently stands for the Clippers is very interesting. I like Paul George. I think I've always said I love Paul George. Paul George is just a very, very interesting guy to me that I think it can do a lot of amazing things. He's a really good defender. And Kawhi just is kind of a standout player.
They're both very similar players, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's just at this point, I think Kawhi Leonard is slightly better, but Paul George was mentioned as a possible MVP candidate this season. He had a great performance. And like you said, he is, I kind of hate the term two-way player, because technically every player is supposed to be playing offense and defense, but but he is an excellent player on both ends of the court, as is Kawhi Leonard. Both of them are lockdown defenders. Both of them are tremendous scorers on offense. And having both of them on the same team now makes them it makes them nearly impossible to score on. This is going to be a really between them and then Patrick Beverley re-signing.
Yeah.
With the Clippers.
Patrick Beverley he's one of those guys that I think is really good, but a lot of people forget about.
And, this is a Clippers team that gave the Warriors fits in the first round. The Warriors were clearly better, but the Clippers took two games off of them. This team without Kawhi Leonard and Paul George managed to push the Warriors to six games. And it was just a tough, gritty team they traded away their best player at the trade deadline and made a playoff run after that. That's how tough and gritty this team is. It was a team of role players and guys who were just tough and gritty and knew how to do their job. And then then they traded away two of those guys, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Danilo Gallinari. But they replaced those guys with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, probably two top five players in the league. So,
I look at this team and I really, really, really am looking at this team being way more defensive than offensive, especially being led by Paul George and Kawhi. But now that takes me into. Right. We look at that and we can kind of future vision what this team will look like. But I'm pretty sure there's going to be a few more moves in here for this Clippers team. But let's talk about their reaction to this from the Lakers. Right. Because the Lakers are going to be the de facto bad guy for the Clippers.
They were hoping to get Kawhi Leonard. And then so not only did they not get him. Which they were kind of like, okay, maybe he'll sign with us, maybe he won't. But then they were completely blindsided by this Paul George move. And so after that, they're basically, we talked last year about their struggles and the fact that when LeBron went down, the young kids stepped up. They did all right. And then it was the old veterans that shit the bed for them.
Yeah.
They traded all their young guys to get Anthony Davis, all of them except for Kyle Kuzma. And then they couldn't, they got Anthony Davis. They still have LeBron. They keep Kyle Kuzma and then they have to fill out the rest of their team somehow. They are hoping to add a third star to that. They were hoping that third star would be Kawhi Leonard. It wasn't. So now they have to go through and settle for whoever's left in free agency, and a lot of those guys are those old veterans that sucked ass last year. So they're bringing back JaVale McGee, they're bringing back Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Rajon Rondo, Alex Caruso. They did sign Danny Green, who is pretty good at now an NBA champion with the Raptors, and a good shooter, so it's never a bad idea to just bring in a guy who can shoot. Same thing with Quinn Cook, who is a backup for the Warriors. And then DeMarcus Cousins is also kind of a sneaky good signing. They've loaded up in response to this. So it's going to be a battle in LA for not just who is the best team in town, but whoever wins that battle might end up being the best team in the league. So let's move on to the third team involved in this, and that's Oklahoma City, because now you guys might be wondering, why the hell would Oklahoma City make this trade? It's like they had Paul George under contract. He was a free agent last season. He signed a 4-year deal. They thought like they didn't think they were going to be involved in this at all. So basically Oklahoma City fans who were up at the time that this news broke basically just got just as blindsided as everybody else did, probably more so. So it turns out that Kawhi Leonard was lobbying Paul George to join him, and he was lobbying the Clippers to try to trade for him. And so Paul George put in a trade request, and Oklahoma City decided that, you know, if he doesn't want to be here, then we got to find a way to get as much for him as they possibly could. So they got the two players I mentioned before, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Danilo Gallinari, who are two useful players. And then they got three unprotected first round picks from the Clippers in 2022, 2024, and 2026. An unprotected first round pick from Miami that the Clippers owned. A protected first round pick from Miami that the Clippers also owned. These two picks are in 2021 and 2023. And then the rights to swap picks in 2023 and 2025. So they basically own the Clippers draft for the next 7 years or so. It is a record haul for draft picks. This is
all orchestrated by Kawhi Leonard.
All orchestrated.
The Bond villain that he is.
the current front runner for executive of the year, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't think that can be stated enough, because I don't think we've ever seen a player, I mean, maybe not even LeBron, who has been able to just single-handedly...
He out-tampered the guy who is basically responsible for tampering.
Yeah, this is... Like, in any sport, I don't think I've seen the entire landscape of the league shift this much in one move. Because had he stayed with the Raptors, then the Eastern Conference teams would have been pretty competitive, but the Raptors would have been a clear favorite to at least repeat as Eastern Conference champions next year, and a pretty strong favorite to repeat as NBA champions. Had he gone to the Lakers, then it would have been over. The Lakers would have won the title. LeBron, Anthony Davis, and Kawhi Leonard on one team would have been unstoppable. But instead, he went to the Clippers and then basically killed off Oklahoma City in the process. So that's one playoff team that's kind of dropped off the map. And then adding him to the Clippers instantly makes the Clippers contenders. Him joining the Clippers on his own makes the Clippers contenders. Paul George coming with him makes them favorites, I would say. And so now the entire NBA is, I mean, I dare I say balanced, at least competitively, like going from a league where it was pretty clear that the Warriors were far and away the dominant team. It took not just like two injuries, but like five injuries to take them out in the finals. Between Kevin Durant going east, things shifting around with a bunch of Eastern Conference teams, we're at an NBA that might be more competitive next year than it has ever been in a long time. It's like the Warriors still have, in both conferences, the Warriors still have a pretty strong lineup when they're still healthy. On top of that, like as part of all these Kevin Durant shenanigans that they managed to sign and trade for D'Angelo Russell. So that is an Eastern Conference All-Star being added to the Warriors. And so the Warriors still, when they are all healthy next year, they are still going to have four All-Stars in their starting lineup. And they brought back Kevon Looney, who played very, very well for them in DeMarcus Cousins' absence. So this is, that's still going to be a really strong team. And then when Klay Thompson's ACL heals, that is going to be a very competitive team. The Lakers are going to be competitive with LeBron and Anthony Davis, and possibly a healthy DeMarcus Cousins. Then you got the Clippers with a strong, with an already strong supporting cast, adding two superstars. You got those three teams. And then we talked last week, probably not enough about how much better the Utah Jazz have gotten.
The
set of moves we were talking about, maybe this might actually be the best team in the Western Conference.
I think it's one of those things. It's a forever moving line until people actually play. And I think right now that line has just been moved a little bit more. I think on paper, looking at the money spent, the Lakers look pretty good, but I think with this, I think they have an instant contest there. I think sneakily, I don't think anybody else is going to look at the Utah Jazz the way we have. I think that is a team that is going to surprise a lot of people, but it shouldn't be unexpected. And then the Warriors are going to always, that locked in roster that the Warriors have is always going to be good. They just have to find those pieces that fit around that. One of those pieces that they're hoping fits around that is D'Angelo Russell, who they got in a sign and trade.
That fit between him and Stephen Curry is kind of suspect. But I think Stephen Curry is an unselfish enough player that I don't think going to matter as much as some people are hoping that it will. That team is not dead. Don't believe anybody that says that they are dead. They're still going to be a good team. And if they get into the playoffs and get Klay Thompson back, that team is going to be dangerous. We're talking about four teams that could possibly come out of the Western Conference, which is more than we can normally speak for. Probably the same sort of thing in the Eastern Conference. Jimmy Butler is now with the Heat. Al Horford is now with the 76ers. The Milwaukee Bucks have reloaded. The Raptors are still good. There are like eight teams that could that could possibly win the title next year. I think that's the flattest field that we've seen in a long time, and so, I think the NBA will reap the benefits of that. I think it's going to be a really enjoyable season.
I don't think there's much to say about this Jimmy Butler going to the Heat, because I think Jimmy Butler in a weird way is still looking for the place that fits him first more than looking for the system and players. I think he had kind of a good time in Philly, but I don't think he had the best time there. Miami is definitely going to be a market that allows him as an individual to shine a bit more. But now I think, depending on how he feels there, that's where the build out is going to start around Jimmy Butler. I don't think they're an instant contest to anything. I think they'll win some pretty good games. Because looking at the two rosters, the roster he came from and the roster he's going to have most likely, I think the 76ers were a better roster to try to build something out with. but it's definitely going to be interesting to see what happens there over the next 2 years.
Yeah, they do have the highest payroll in the entire league now.
Mm-hmm.
Because this move was a sign and trade. So that'll be interesting to see how they get out of that, how they try to build up. Oklahoma City was one of those teams where they had the highest, I believe they had the highest payroll in the league last year, and they had basically peaked. So this move looks bad for them because they lost a superstar in Paul George, and it came out of nowhere. But this is a massive haul of draft picks they got. Sure, they might be late first round picks because the Clippers are probably going to be good, but who knows how long the Clippers being good is going to last. Mm-hmm. These picks go all the way out until 2026.
At the same time, those picks could be something that you move early rather than late. Maybe they're not necessarily something you sit on. Maybe they're something you turn into instant value in trying to shop around, right? There's something you can kind of throw on the table that you don't mind giving up if you think you're going to get more instant value. But then they're also something that have a lot of projection towards you, right? There's something you can play with. There's something you can be like, okay, what is going to come out of, let's look at the college system. Let's look at what comes out at this year and at this year and at this year. Are those things that we could look forward to, even if they are late round picks? Would there possibly be things there? You know what I mean? Like those picks have a lot around them, and it has a lot of time to play with them too. So it's definitely going to be really interesting to see how those picks get used. I think some of them will definitely get used in trade talks to get roster spots filled on players that they think right now could fit. But I don't know. It's just weird.
Or they could just decide to blow it all up. Like one last thing before we move on. But like there's talks now that this is not necessarily the end of free agency. Because of all these orchestrated moves, because Paul George is now gone, now Russell Westbrook is kind of just stuck in Oklahoma City, with a massive contract,
just putting that out there.
I mean, sure, he's going to make a lot of money, but he's probably not going to win a lot of stuff. Yes. So he might want to go somewhere else.
Yeah. Let me just say, because the Pistons have been in the rumors for Russell Westbrook, if the Knicks want him, they can have him.
I don't want him either. No, I said that. I said that, and I immediately regretted it.
No, and with the Pistons being in the rumor mill, I don't want him either. I don't want him.
Yeah, so I mean, he is that kind of player. So like the Thunder were kind of stuck. Like they didn't have a place. They couldn't move upward because they wouldn't have any of the cap space to do that. And they peaked at a first round exit. Damian Lillard hit a shot over Paul George and basically sent them home. And that was the last thing Paul George ever did for the Oklahoma City Thunder. And then, and that's where they peaked in the first round, and they had the highest payroll in the league, no room to move up. So this move gives them a lot of flexibility. If they want to blow the whole thing up and trade Russell Westbrook, they can do that. There will be some team out there that will take him and his massive contract. He is still a good player, despite like whatever misgivings people might have about the way he plays. He still is a good player. So, this basically, my point is, this isn't the end of free agency. Like, now people are talking about, where is Russell Westbrook going to go? Are the Thunder going to trade him? This hasn't ended. NBA free agency just keeps on going.
The saddest thought just popped into my head, and then we can move on from here. Even though me and DJM just made that joke that neither one of us as fans of our two teams want him, somehow, some way, I feel like he's going to end up on one of those two teams. And I feel like if it does end up on the Knicks, it's going to be because they traded their two most recent draft picks to get Russell Westbrook, and then somehow, some way, those two players are going to go to Oklahoma and be like the best duo to ever play basketball in existence. And then once again, we'll just look at the Knicks as what the fuck did you just
do? That is exactly what I'm worried about with the Pistons, because Luke Kennard is going to be a trade ship, and then Luke Kennard gets traded and becomes the best three-point shooter ever, and I don't want that to happen.
Oh my goodness. All right, let's end the show on some oddities, and the best oddities of all are baseball.
So the story was brought to my attention by my coworker Joe, who listens to this show. Thank you.
Shout out to Joe.
The Dodgers beat the Diamondbacks on 5 straight walks the other day. Yeah, so they were trailing 3 runs to 4 going into the bottom of the 9th inning. They got two outs. So things are not looking good. Chris Taylor comes out to the plate. He falls behind in the count. 0 balls, 2 strikes. And then somehow Diamondbacks closer Greg Holland, who I think is 12 out of 14 save opportunities he's managed to capitalize on. So, you know, normally very reliable. This is definitely a save situation, down one run, or sorry, up one run, going into the bottom of the 9th. Ahead, 0 balls, 2 strikes in the count, and he throws 4 straight balls to walk Chris Taylor. And then next batter up, the count reaches a full count, and then walks him again. And then Dugo comes up, walks him with 4 pitches, with 5 pitches. And this was after the pitching coach came out to try to calm him down. So now 3 straight walks, bases loaded, 2 outs. And then he walks Matt Beattie. So 4 straight walks, game tying run, and scores just without having to make contact with the ball at all. And then at this point, the Diamondbacks are like, all right, this guy's in full meltdown mode. Time to make a pitching change. So then they bring in TJ McFarland to come in and face Cody Bellinger, who is one of the league's premier players this year, having a great season. And you've got to come in basically without warning. And I don't know how much of a warm up you get when, in a situation like this where you're totally expecting your reliable closer to shut this down.
I think looking at this situation, looking at it, how detail you have it laid out, right? I think the Holland on full count puts the pitching staff on alert, and they probably just send somebody out just in case. Then by the time the pitching coach goes out there and talks to him, somebody's warming up.
A lot of times that's used as like a delay tactic to get somebody a couple extra warm-up pitches.
I think then you hit that four straight, you're like, I don't care how warmed up you are, you have to be better than what's happening in front of me.
Yeah, but he wasn't.
Well, okay, hold on. Of all the fuckery in this, right, he went out there, faced one guy, and fucked up. This guy had 3 opportunities. No, wait, he had 4 opportunities in front of him, and fucked them. Like that gets in. That's not only in your. You're not only in your head at that point. You're the shit in your head has spread like a disease.
Yeah, that's true. Like I think like that kind of meltdown mentality. It's like It can definitely pervade a team. This is like the Houston Rockets missing 20-some straight free throw, or sorry, missing 20-some straight three-pointers. Like, this is, like, you start wondering whether, like, there's a curse at work here or something. Like, this is, you don't know what's happening with you, and you don't know whether you've poisoned everybody else. Everybody else is wondering whether you've poisoned them too. So, like, you lose confidence. Everybody else loses confidence. Everybody's just like, oh, my God, don't blow this. Don't blow this. Don't blow this. It changes everybody's mentality from, like, let's just win this to like, holy shit, I hope we don't lose this. What are people going to say about us if we lose this? This is bad. And, yeah, I mean, that's basically what happened here. And the Dodgers almost didn't have to do anything except be patient at the plate. They didn't get a single hit here, but somehow managed to score two runs while down one. And yeah, like I've seen walk-off walks before. I've never seen five straight walks to throw a game. Like they literally threw the game. Like just by missing the strike zone over and over and over and over again. They had this game in their grasp. They were one pitch away, and they blew it worse than I think I've ever seen before from any baseball team. Just on their own, just the pitchers themselves just shat the bed. And it required no hitting on the part of the Dodgers to do this. So, you know, it is just one game out of 162, so that's the only consolation in this.
Let's speaking of this meltdown, let's move on to the meltdown that is the Mets. And this is the one high regard I have in being a Yankees fan, because I don't think the Yankees could fuck up this bad.
Yeah, it's almost like there's like a rule in every sport that only one New York team is allowed to be good at the same time. I mean, like, ever since the Mets and the Yankees met in the World Series, like, way back when we were kids.
Yeah.
Like, since then, it's always, like, one of the New York teams has to suck, and they can't just suck. They have to suck in like, a really, really embarrassing fashion. So,
oh, fuck, is that what's happening to the Knicks right now?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and the Nets are good, so that's one good, one bad. So the Mets have been kind of their own level of embarrassment for a while. This case is kind of a not related to the baseball that they're playing right now. This was a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the 1969 team that won the World Series. They invited a lot of the people that were part of that team to be a part of this celebration. And then obviously some people couldn't make it because they're not alive anymore. So they show an in memoriam slideshow. Two of the people on that slideshow, Jim Gostert and Jesse Hudson, actually were still alive. So, they're not dead, but they made everybody think they were dead for a while, which is kind of embarrassing because Jim Gostert is actually pretty active on social media. So, like, it's not like he's a name that's completely disappeared. He only played for that team for like 10 games, but they chose to put him to like involve him somehow in this ceremony. And he's kind of surprised to be even involved at all because he didn't even get a ring for being a part of that team, and like several other players didn't either, and that's kind of been one thing that he's been upset about for a while. But for some reason they thought to include him, but they didn't bother to check whether he was still alive.
I'm going to give the Mets the benefit of the doubt because I have a weird system where if I haven't talked to anyone in like 5 years, I assume that they might be dead. And maybe that's what the Mets did.
But then you don't do like a presentation about them and announce that they're dead. Like it's different than like not knowing that, you know, there's a difference between somebody being dead to you and then you going out and like giving them a eulogy, which is basically what they did here. So they realized pretty quickly that they screwed this up.
Yeah,
they tried to apologize to both players. Somebody called, reached out and called both players and apologized. And then the next game on Sunday, they put out like a big thing on the LED board, just a kind of a paragraph of text apologizing to both of them, and then in that they spelled Jesse Hudson's name wrong. So
yeah, twice
they failed to Google properly, both to check whether these people were still alive and then to check whether they had their name spelled correctly.
You know why they probably fucked that up? It's probably because they are spending an exorbitant amount of money on a player that still no longer plays for them.
Yes. So Monday, July 1st, was Bobby Bonilla Day. And this is one of my favorite facts in sports. Bobby Bonilla has not played with the Mets since 1999. In 2000, they agreed to buy out his contract for $5.9 million. But they're also somehow involved in the Bernie Madoff scandal at the time. So they were really, really short on cash. So they struck an agreement instead that they would pay Bonilla $1.19 million every year for 25 years, starting in 2011. So Bonilla is going to be paid a total of $29.8 million for a $5.9 million debt. And he hasn't played a game for them since 1999. Their sixth payment this past Monday. They will continue to make 19 more payments. This will not end until 2035. So every year on July 1st, we will be reminded of the ultimate keep getting them checks player, Bobby Bonilla. apparently this isn't the only deferred contract plan that he has with the Mets. He has another one, but both involving the Mets and Orioles, paying him $500,000 a year for 25 years. And those payments began in 2004. So this guy
So Giavisi said it, but Giavisi has this saying of keep getting those checks. You put in the work, you earn your keep, and sometimes it works out in your favor. This is the de facto. This worked out in your favor. You ain't got to do nothing. Yeah. You're going to make $1 million a year.
Yeah, dude's 56 years old, and he's still collecting baseball checks. I don't know, like, it. Somebody presented him with a good deal, and mm-hmm. he took it. So
yeah. Speaking of, DJM just throws a thing at us to add to the downfall of their Mets. Their GM Brody Van, you know you're a man when your name's Brody Van, is in a little bit of trouble for
Van Wagenen. Brody Van Wagenen.
No, we're just going to call him Brody Van. I like that name. No,
Brody Van Wagenen
threw a chair during a meeting with the coaching staff.
Wow. And this was just today. So tough week for the Mets. But
he probably threw that chair because he was mad that he had to just pay a guy who doesn't play him $1 million.
It's like there's an entire like category tag for Deadspin that's just lol Mets. Like they've reached next levels of dysfunction. I really think that is a rule. Like you can't have both New York teams good at the same time. Otherwise, it's just unfair money wise to the rest of the league. So incredibly unlucky.
When does Rob Manfred step in on the Mets? Like, my God.
I think there are sometimes there are just things you just
It's like with the Tampa Bay Rays. Like, eventually, Rob Manfred, commissioner of baseball, has just got to come in. Like, every few years, whether it was David Stern or Adam Silver in the NBA, they would occasionally step in and just be like, with one organization or another or some kind of transaction, it's just like, okay, you know what? This has gone on long enough. Okay, enough. When does Rob Manfred step in on the Mets?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you brought that up because it kind of goes back to the Clippers thing. Like, 5 years ago, the Clippers, or maybe 6 years ago, I might have the dates wrong, but they were owned by Donald Sterling. They were in the second largest market in the NBA, and they were content to just sit there and profit off of that. And, you know, they never improved the team. They were owned by... you know, a notoriously racist slumlord, and you know, like he was an embarrassment to the league, and the Clippers were just a perennial embarrassment, and you know, and it took the leak of him saying some very racist things publicly, or it took that tape to be released publicly to finally get the league to step in and say, okay, you as a person and as a person associated with this team are such a drain on this league. Like, they share revenue. So him being a part of this is costing the Clippers money. And it's costing them so much money that it's a significant detriment to the rest of the league, because the rest of the league can't share all of that money that was that's being wasted away, or being not earned, because Donald Sterling is in charge of this team. So that was their logic for, or at least that's what I believe is their underlying logic for stepping in and suspending Donald Sterling for life, which then prompted him to finally sell the team. Like, short of doing anything like that, that is that embarrassing. Like, as we talked about with the Echo Fox thing, like, it's hard to force an owner to sell their team. So like, when the league steps in and does something like that, they kind of try to do it in a more subversive, not overt way. Like, they didn't like the Philadelphia 76ers engaging in the process and tanking for 5 years straight. So they went in and orchestrated Brian Colangelo taking over the general managership of the team over Sam Hinkie, which then backfired on them because of the whole burner phone scandal. So there are ways they can get involved, but you're probably not going to see them explicitly tell Knicks owner James Dolan that, like, you are fucking this up badly, so you have to sell the team. They can't really do that unless he does something just awful and super embarrassing, and the same thing is going to be true with the Mets. Like, they can't step in just because they're incompetent, or at least not explicitly. So yeah, that's I know that's a depressing note to end on, but if you want to find out about more Knicks and Mets shenanigans, keep following Sports Odds and Ends. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com to find links to find our show notes, links to iTunes and Google Play, and all the different places that you can subscribe to the show. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next time.